I'm prepared to do anything I can
to play again. Do it then. What about your start to the game?
I was, it wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Exciting news, Kev. We are live on Facebook Live.
Oh.
The future's here, and it's now.
Where were we being watched from?
Those cameras, I presume.
Can put me back on the camera there.
On the old Gary Kelly kissing you when it was uninvited.
Yeah.
He hadn't asked you for permission
Just come up and give you a kiss.
Unhygienic. Yeah. You don't know, is Gary ever cold sore that week? You don't want to think about these kind of things. Yeah. It jogged in
some,
my...
Some might think without don't know where he's been, but... Yeah. Yeah.
Jogged a memory of mine. I played in a team once upon a time, Leinster Senior League. We won a cup, had the celebration. Everyone very excited, you know. And I noticed all the lads were over in the far corner, you know, all sorts of drink going into the trophy and drinking out of it. And it was a great night and blah, 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 you know. And it wasn't the end of the season. It was obviously some competition that was on midway through the season. And within a few days, a very high percentage of the lads who were drinking out of that trophy were at training with cold sores. The dirty dozen.
I thought you were going to say y'all went out and started kissing each other or something.
No.
Yeah.
But as good as. Yeah. Cold sore went round the squad. It was rife.
That's what happens, isn't it?
I was delighted I hadn't partaken. We have a busy show this evening, so we're going to talk to David Preece, a goalkeeper with Sunderland and Darlington, who is of the opinion that walls from outside 25 yards anyway from the goal are of no use to goalkeepers and thinks they should be done away with, are certainly words to that effect. So we'll have an interesting chat with him about walls and the various ways that you can innovate with your walls. Do you jump is a whole other point.
Yeah.
Are we jumping or are we not jumping is a conversation a lot of walls have had.
Yeah.
And someone says, don't jump. No, we'll jump.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So we'll talk to David Preece, who's always really interesting on these things. And in a few moments, we'll talk to Dan Rowan as well, the BBC sports editor, about the Ennio Luco case, which I'm sure has caught your attention during the week. Very complicated. There's a lot going on in this case.
Yeah.
We'll just lay out the bare facts, I think, and give you a timeline. And some of the stuff is very striking, to say the least. So we'll talk to Dan Rowan of the BBC shortly. Also on the day, Kevin, that Wayne Rooney has decided to say thanks but no thanks.
Yeah.
After Gareth Southgate, it seems, according to Wayne himself, called him up. It was great that Gareth called me this week to tell me he wanted me back in the England squad for the upcoming matches. Really appreciated that. However, having already thought long and hard, I told Gareth I had now decided to retire for good from international football.
Yeah.
You were saying you weren't surprised at this at all.
No, I actually heard Phil Neville talking about it. I think Phil Neville was on Five Live commentating on the game on Monday evening as well, talking about Wayne Rooney just perhaps maybe wanting to take a step back from it. He never actually talked about retirement, but in my head I was thinking, wouldn't surprise me if he retired. If as we were led to believe that England were very, very impressed with the way that he started, he looks lean. We spoke about he looks happy.
I said to Kenny Cunningham, he looks lean. And Kenny said, well, leaner.
No, I think he looks lean. He looks fit. Yeah, well, Kenny thinks that Emre Can's a poor player as well, and he scored a couple of goals tonight. So I'll get Kenny on that sometime again. But no, I think he looks lean. I think he looks healthy. I think he looks hungry.
Happy.
Happy. Happy's the main thing, yeah. And his wife's expecting another child as well. He's all round. It seems to me like he's in a good place anyway. And I just thought if that... As the talk, usually the journals, the Henry Winters and all these lads, the main lads that normally follow the English squad, if they're printing that story, they're getting that story out that you suggest he will be called up. And I thought, there's no reason for him now. He's done his bit. And it just didn't surprise me when he announced it. Didn't surprise me at all today, no.
Doesn't need the hassle?
He's just never looked happy in the last few years playing for England. He's not looked happy. Looks as though it's been a burden on him. You know, that England captaincy and the pressure that's probably come with him for that, come with being that captain, and the constant criticism of him that he's received, both playing for the biggest club, one of the biggest clubs in the world, and playing for England. I think it's gone to United. Gone to Everton now, and it's just opened his eyes, refreshing to see that, or to see him play now, the way that he's playing, the way that he looks happy again in himself, seeing the Wayne Rooney evolved in many respects.
So almost, I'm going to enjoy this part of my career.
Yeah, he's still 31. He's still got something to give.
Yeah.
Not necessarily going to play every week at Everton, albeit he started the season well within that. I think he can enjoy his football now and show what a good player he actually is.
Also, I suppose if he was to go back in with England, he's signing up for... not as straightforward an experience. He'll be on the bench a lot. Certain squads he mightn't get called up for. Yeah. It'll be a phasing out at times. He'll be in other times. There'll be lots of debate around him. Should he be playing? Should he not be playing? There were even polls on Sky Sports' The Debate last night.
Yeah.
All of that noise around the whole thing is suddenly done away with, and maybe that's part of the attraction. He said, I will always remain a passionate England fan. One of my very few regrets is not to have been part of a successful England tournament side. So Rooney's played in 3 World Cups and 3 European Championships. Before I even looked into it this morning when I heard the news, the two standout memories I have of Rooney are one, tearing Portugal asunder in 2004 at that European Championship.
Just when he left us that summer actually to go to United from Everton, yeah.
And then two, saying down the camera at the World Cup in 2010 that it was pretty disgraceful that the England fans were booing their own team. Yeah. What's that about? And just a really rocky period in his relationship with the fans and ultimately a kind of microcosm moment of it. The lack of success ultimately he had subsequent to 2004 at pretty much every major tournament he played in. Did he have another great tournament for England? I use the word great.
No, probably didn't. That was his main one, and of course that ended with injury. You think about the time when he broke his metatarsal. Was it against Bayern Munich? Was that the lead up to 10? Is that right?
Yeah,
I think that was right. And that was when he was flying. He'd scored around 30 Premier League goals, something like that. He was absolutely flying that season. Broke his foot, and that put him out. And then he came back to play after maybe a short recovery, or quick recovery, should I say. And he didn't look right through that tournament. He hadn't had enough game time. Wayne's physique, his body suggests that he needs to be out there training every day at full tilt. The way that he used to train at Everton was full on every single day. Play, train as you play. I think that's the old adage, but certainly Wayne did that. And I think that time off the training ground certainly hindered him going into that tournament. And probably, I think since then, the tournaments that England were involved in, he didn't have any major any real major impact in those tournaments, no.
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult to sum up his career because
I don't think it's difficult to sum up his career. Honestly, I don't. I think we sum him up because I think he is still considered in some people's eyes as an England great. You could argue that all you want to, but he's had an incredible football career.
Sure.
To score 200 Premier League goals, it's just immense.
Agreed.
It's unbelievable.
I'm talking about him though in the context of in 2004, the nickname is the White Pele. I'm talking about him as the guy who broke Bobby Charlton's goal scoring record, this very iconic record. So in that context, it's difficult, and you'd have to say he underperformed for England at the big tournaments. But then I have a huge degree of sympathy for him.
Yeah, I take you that, yeah.
A huge degree of sympathy for him as well, because it's difficult to perform at your best if you're in a dysfunctional side or a side that's not dominating games against lesser opposition. It's very hard for anyone to look great in a team that's not going well. So it's hard to know to what extent he was hindered by the issues England were having at a broader level in tournaments. You know?
I think that the other factor is, you know, we talk about the greats of the game now. You talk about the Bobby Charltons, certainly the England greats, the Bobby Charltons, whoever you're going to throw into that mix. With the finances that have come into the game, it's changed professional football's careers immeasurably. We all know that. But with that has come that pressure, the pressure going into the tournaments and the hype around the tournaments. Could these players have coped with the pressure that the modern day footballer has? There is that downside and upside to both of it.
Sure.
You know, that's the thing. So we could never know whether Bobby Charlton would have coped or whether Wayne Rooney would have coped during Bobby Charlton's era. We'll never know that. But I do know, you know, I playing the games that I've played international football, it's a certain pressure, different pressure when you are playing for your country without a shadow of a doubt, yeah.
Yeah, well, after 119 appearances and 53 goals, Wayne Rooney has said, I'm done with all that pressure for the time being. Anyway, we'll turn to the other big story this week. And again, it's Liverpool 4, Hoffenheim 1, 6-2 on aggregate, 77 minutes on the clock at Anfield. We've got Dan Rowan, the BBC sports editor, standing by. Evening, Dan.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
Very well. So we're into probably a bit of a legal minefield here. And as much as anything, we probably just want to lay out the facts as best we can, because this story is not uncomplicated.
It's complex and it's difficult, not least for those of us trying to cover it. The facts, shall I just run through them? Because it does take a while, so forgive me. But
well, I'll tee you up bit by bit and we'll work our way through that. And then if I understand where you're taking me, then hopefully all the listeners will as well. So we're talking about Ennio Lucco, 30 years old, been with Chelsea since 2012. 102 appearances for England between 04 and 2016. And so in the past week, people will have seen Ennio Lucco speaking to various people, including yourself, and we'll play a clip of your interview with her in a moment. And so she's come forward publicly because she'd signed a confidentiality agreement with the FA, which is subsequently void because this issue has come to light anyway. So she's allowed to speak publicly about an incident involving her and her England coach, Mark Sampson, which took place back in November 2014 before the Germany match.
That is correct. And you're referring to a case involving Ebola, because what she claims that he said, and this was revealed in the interview we did with her on Sunday, which aired on Monday evening, is that before big game against Germany in 2014, she was speaking to her manager, Mark Sampson, and she says, asked if her family was going to come over for the match. She said that they were, and he said, make sure they don't bring Ebola with them. They were flying over from Nigeria. Now, it's important to stress, he hasn't given any official comment, but we understand that he vehemently denies ever having said that. There were two levels, though, to that accusation. One was the fact that it was said in the first place, and then the other dimension of it was that Ennio Lucco told me that she had provided some evidence, or at least informed the FA, that this had allegedly occurred, but that it was never part of their reviews. They conducted two reviews into her claims, of which this was one. One was internal, one was conducted as an external investigation, headed up by a very prominent and experienced employment lawyer called Catherine Newton, QC. So it is complex, this, but this was a new revelation, this was a new claim, and the FA, on that basis, on that particular claim, say that they accept that they were made aware of this allegation in correspondence that had taken place between themselves and the PFA, who at that time were advising Lucco and helping her with this grievance, but that it was never included as one of her eight allegations that then formed the official complaint, and therefore it wasn't taken any further. So that's their explanation as to why that wasn't proceeded with. But this is just one element of a much wider issue.
Okay, so there was these various investigations are hard to keep track of. There was a culture review, a culture review in May 2016, where she was asked to partake. She'd been on the team for 11 years, and so she seemed like a good player candidate to talk about the culture in the team. And she says of that. I know I would never have participated in an exercise like that culture review and lied. And she says, yet the irony is that lying would have saved me. If I'd been untruthful, we wouldn't be having this conversation. To have said everything's hunky-dory, everything's fantastic. I had two great years with the England women's team manager, Mark Simpson, and the culture is great, would have saved me. So this culture review in May 2016 is where she chatted in a bit of depth about what had happened to the FA. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. Okay. So she complained about what she referred to as bullying, harassment, discrimination, having been asked to participate in this review. And then, as I said, two investigations took place.
That chat prompted further investigations?
Correct, okay. That's correct. And then she said, I mean, let's go through some of them. And she said that she'd been belittled, she'd been singled out by Sampson and some of his coaches. She claimed that during a meeting at the China Cup in 2015, Sampson made what she called a highly inappropriate remark with racial connotations to an unnamed mixed-race player. She said that Sampson had asked this player how many times she'd been arrested, and that Lucco was of the view that was because she was of mixed race. However, it's again important to say that the independent review found no evidence to support that allegation, and a video of the meeting did not show the comment ever having been said. But as you suggested just then, Joe, she also made a big claim that the decision to drop her from the squad was retaliatory action, in effect, for the concerns that she'd raised. So there's parallels here with the Jess Varnish case with British Cycling, where she effectively said that the reason she'd been kicked off of the Olympic program by British Cycling was because she'd criticised the coach Shane Sutton. Now, he denies that. This is a long saga as well. But there are definitely parallels with this case. So, but the difference here is the review again concluded that she hadn't been treated in such a manner. Sampson was fully cleared. Despite that, it turned out, as you said, that the FA had paid her $80,000 as part of an out-of-court mutual settlement. And it's that, I think, which has got the FA into some difficulty, because that obviously led to concerns that this was effectively hush money. Mm. They deny that. They say she was always free to discuss the facts of the case, and that it was merely because they wanted to avoid this going to an employment tribunal and getting very messy, because in that case, it would have gone public. there would have been players, and Sampson himself would have been called to give evidence as witnesses, and that would have been in the build-up to the Euros. And obviously they were keen to avoid that earlier this summer.
Yeah.
England made the semi-finals, didn't they? So that was their explanation as to why that deal was agreed, yeah, even though Sampson had been cleared. But of course, people wondered, why were you paying her that much money when nothing was wrong? So this is what's, I think, got them into some tricky waters here.
Yeah. So the incident happens in November 2014, the Ebola comment, and then there's the culture review in May 2016, and you referenced this point, but it's worth just teasing out again for the listeners. So Aluko says she was promised that the culture review was very much a confidential process, and she raised these grievances, which you've mentioned, like the asking the player, the anonymous player, how many times you've been arrested, for instance. And she was, again, no video of that, but she raises these grievances. And then she says that she was told it was confidential. A week later, she claims that Sampson, the England manager, visited her at Chelsea's training ground. And
yeah,
this is a player with 102 caps and 11-year career, saying she was being dropped. She said, a week later, I had a visit from Mark Sampson to Cobham. I thought he was going to talk about my role in the next England camp. I'd been assured it was a confidential report and that my name would be anonymised so I could speak freely. Instead, he told me he was dropping me. When I asked why, he said it was because of un-lioness behaviour. I was shocked, but I said, OK, can you give me some examples? You need to give me some examples because as far as I'm concerned, I played 90 minutes in the last game against Bosnia. I thought I had a good game and nobody said anything to me about being badly behaved. The best he could come up with was that I had looked withdrawn in meetings. She does not think this is a coincidence, clearly.
No, she thinks the two things are directly linked. That's certainly her impression. That's certainly her fear, she says. She simply thinks it's too much of a coincidence for her, given her record. I mean, after all, she was the leading goal scorer in the Women's Super League last year. As you say, 102 caps. She hadn't been dropped in 11-odd years. And then suddenly, just a few days after, she happens to have given pretty, you know, relatively explosive allegations about the England manager himself to this, what she thought was a confidential review, she suddenly gets dropped. Now, it could be a complete coincidence, and the FA are insistent that there was no way that information would have been shared. She gave the information initially over the phone to an independent consultant who had been brought in, an expert in team cultures, and he is adamant that he didn't share it with anybody. It didn't find its way back to Sampson, and he didn't use it against her. So we're in a situation here where it's her word against his, her word against the FA's, and it's highly unsatisfactory for all concerned. I think, again, she goes on, though, in that interview on Sunday, she told me that she thinks the investigations were flawed because key witnesses weren't spoken to. So, for example, that unnamed mixed-race player at the China Cup, for example,
yeah,
she says that, you know, backing up her claim that these investigations were a farce, is the fact that the FA or the independent QC didn't talk to this player. Now, again, the FA have an explanation for that. They say the reason for that is purely because Aluko didn't want to name that player. We won't name her now. And therefore, how could they speak to her? The trouble is that it's pretty easy to identify this player if you want to. In fact, most of us managed to in a few minutes because there were enough clues given in the written judgment that the FA published under some pressure on Friday to work it out pretty easily. So it does raise a question as to why the FA, you know, didn't work it out pretty quickly and take it upon themselves. If they really want to get to the bottom of all this and interview this player. The same applies to the Ebola incident. There are some critics who would argue that just because Aluko didn't include it ultimately in her final complaint officially, the fact that the FA knew about this possibility means they should have perhaps taken the initiative, been a bit more curious, and followed it up regardless. So you have this added element to this as to whether or not the investigations were of a sufficient thoroughness, really. The FA say they're confident they were. And, of course, they do point out as well, and it's an important point, Joe, that Aluko declined to participate in that external review. She said that she wanted no part of it in the end because she'd lost faith in it.
Yeah. We have a clip of your interview with her, Dan, and here she is telling you why she's chosen to speak out now.
I feel that there's a lot of half-truths out in the public, and I think it's in the public interest now to understand the severity of this case, to understand that this isn't something I decided to fabricate out of the blue. This wasn't a bitter, impassioned revenge at an England manager. This was something I was asked to do. You know, I was asked to be part of this confidential exercise. What does this case represent to present players and future players of England. Now, if ever anybody, God forbid, was going through something difficult right now in the team, would they speak out, judging on what's happened to me over the last 2 weeks? I don't think they would. That is the most damaging thing about all this, because if you think of a young player, for instance, who wants to play for England in the future, let's even say a young black player that wants to play for England in the future, she's going to look at this and go, oh, if anything ever happens to me, what happened to Anyaluko? I can't say anything. That, to me, is the most heartbreaking thing.
You fear this will deter whistleblowers?
100%. I do not think players are going to feel confident sharing grievances with the Football Association again. And in a football environment where, you know, it's ups and downs, there's pressure, managers say things sometimes, players are treated certain ways sometimes, there's no getting away from that. That's dangerous, in my opinion. It's dangerous if players feel like they cannot speak out about certain things. That is a dangerous culture to be putting in the public domain.
So you believe the two things were linked? What you'd reported back and you being dropped were linked?
I can only state the facts, and the fact is that a week before I was dropped from the England team for the first time in 11 years, I had given my account of what I felt was discrimination towards me, what I felt was a bullying culture, and what I felt was, a pattern of behaviour towards me that other individuals had not been through in the team. I was an England player at the time. I had a phone conversation. A week later, I was dropped from the England team and haven't played for England since.
Dan, I'll admit I'm struggling not to editorialise here, but we'll press on. Another point worth mentioning is that one of the FA's internal reviews took place, on the back of Aluko's accusations. The inquiry did not speak to Leanne Sanderson, and she was one of the players who was named as a key witness. So they didn't speak to a key witness here. The FA does not dispute that they didn't do this. They said there were timing and logistical issues, but that is troubling. And then there is another part to all of this, believe it or not. As I think people can hear there, Aluko is clearly very, very smart, very eloquent. It won't surprise people to learn that she works as a lawyer as well for a football agency. Now, FA rules state that if you're a footballer, you can't represent other players as an agent, is Aluko's point. She says she wasn't representing players as an agent. She was working as a lawyer, which is obviously very different. And she says she had been doing that for 5 years and there'd never been a problem. And the FA was aware of her work and celebrated her work, she says. And it seems that shortly after all this trouble started, after this investigation, she got an email from the FA to say that she was under investigation from the anti-corruption unit. And has she had to leave her job?
Well, yes, effectively, she had to give up that opportunity. And again, what she said is the timing that raises her suspicions. And again, it could just be a coincidence. But as you've intimated, it's awkward for the FA. I mean, all this could be completely innocent and due process. You know, it absolutely could have been followed as it should be. But it's not just that. It's the timing of her being dropped. It's the fact they didn't interview people like Leanne Sanderson or the unnamed mixed-race player who it would have been easy to identify. It's the fact they didn't follow up on the fact they knew about this alleged Ebola reference. It's the fact they haven't commented since she spoke out on Monday. All this sort of adds a little bit of pressure to the FA, and that is why the likes of anti-racism group Kick It Out have called for a new review into the way this was handled. The Professional Footballers Association has followed them and called for an entirely new inquiry, where they want to have a role in the appointment of whichever legal expert is appointed to head that up this time. Shadow Sports Minister Dr. Rosina Allen-Khan has weighed in today as well. She's also backed these calls for a new review. Mm. Chelsea have come out, haven't they, in support of Aluko, which has just again ratcheted up the pressure on the FA. They are still very much supportive privately of Sampson, and he hasn't spoken out yet. I think he has to at some stage. He's due to give a press conference I think maybe next week. There's a squad announcement ahead of England's next match against Germany, I believe. Against Russia, sorry. And so unless they want that press conference to descend into a pretty unpleasant experience for him. They will be well advised to, I'd suggest, do something between now and then. But let's see. It's difficult. They're in a difficult position. He was cleared by not just one but two reviews. We should remember that.
Yeah.
And he's been a very successful manager for that side. Let's not forget. You know, he's led the Lionesses to two semi-finals, World Cup, and now the European Championships too. And he retains the loyalty, I think it's fair to say, of a large number of players. Having said that, you've mentioned Leanne Sanderson, and she's come out in support of Aluko. She herself has said that she thinks that because of that, she won't get picked again when she's available after injury. It's a bitter dispute, this, and it's tricky because ultimately, as I said earlier, it's one person's word against another's, which is never ideal. Mm. But it is a fascinating and a big story right now.
Dan, sorry, just one thing, just in relation to Mark Sampson getting cleared. You mentioned earlier on that England film team meetings, is that standard practice within the FA?
I don't know. I don't know whether it's across all of the different representative England teams, but certainly it's known that within the Sampson regime, that is something that he likes, that he's done. I don't know what the reasoning is. But that is important in this case because that claim of the Lukos regarding that China Cup incident, the meeting where he's meant to have referred to this player being arrested or how many times she may have been arrested, doesn't appear. According to the external independent investigation headed up by Catherine Newton, there was no record of that on the video of that meeting, which obviously doesn't help Aluko's case, and it explains one of the reasons why he was cleared of that. But there, again, something which has come out in the last few days is whether or not the FA might want to release that video. So they're finding themselves under scrutiny. But yes, it's an interesting part of the Sampson regime, and so far it's been a successful one. So we'll have to see what his next move is.
Dan, you've explained all that brilliantly. Thanks very much. Much appreciated.
Not at all.
That's Dan Rowan there, the BBC's sports editor.
It just doesn't sound very. It's just so murky, isn't it? I've worked
just
alongside.
Just going to let that hang there for a few minutes.
I've worked alongside with the BBC and done a few things with her, some of the shows, and maybe backing up what Dan's saying there and what you're saying yourself. Very, very intelligent.
You've worked with Aluko?
Yes.
Oh.
She'd obviously done this report, and she'd obviously had this. This is years old. This alleged incident.
Yeah, 2014.
Yeah. So there was no suggestion though within her of this. I saw her recently saying as well. She's kept quiet. She said nothing. She's not necessarily wanting to shout this from the rooftop. There was no suggestion. I hadn't heard anything. Having worked with her and even known some of her representatives that I would have spoken to regarding any. No suggestion for this whatsoever. So timing. You know, you suggest that obviously it's the FA that's pushing this agenda now, aren't they? They're the one that's pushing it out. They're the one that have obviously paid any what she thinks, or what in many things, in my eyes, it looks as though she's been paid off essentially, hasn't it? That's the way it looks. I'm not saying that's the case, but that's the way it certainly looks. Mm. It just doesn't sit right at all.
No,
any way, shape, or form. This no.
There are some extraordinary coincidences in the direction of her career. Subsequent to making the
totally,
complaints.
Top scorer, and
still playing well, 30 years of age.
Yeah, she would be one of the well-known England players.
Yeah,
and if that was said to her as well, the other one which said she was dropped for un-Lioness behaviour. What is Lioness behaviour then? That's the thing.
I wouldn't like to know the answer.
Yeah,
yeah. No, that's it's actually extraordinary stuff. So we'll take a break. Liverpool have gone full time. They're in the Champions League, Liverpool fans. Exciting times ahead. 4-2 winners over Hoffenheim, 6-3 in aggregate. We are talking to David Priest next, who's always a very good guest. He's a goalkeeping coach now, did play for Sunderland in his day. Will tell us why he thinks Wolves are no good.
Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Watch 42 live Premier League games this season on the Air Sport Pack.
Welcome back. David Priest is on the line. He's played for Darlington, Sunderland, works as a goalkeeping coach now. He's been on the show before. Good to have you back. Evening, David.
Good evening, gents. How are you?
Very well. So, the wall. Talk us about the wall. 1957, you pointed out in your piece in the Times, was the first time the world of football saw a wall. Northern Ireland, of all teams, against Italy in Rome. Danny Blanchflower, we tried to do things that nobody else had ever thought of. So talk to us. Your sense of the wall is that further away from goal you go, less valuable the wall is.
Yeah, it come after Trent Alexander-Arnold's free kick against Hoffenheim last week. It looked as be somewhere between 29, 30 yards out. And it seems from that distance, I've said this many times, that you know, if you put one player or two players on the pitch, the goalkeeper and a striker of the ball, 30 yards from goal, and you ask him to beat him with no players in between, very rarely would he be able to beat the keeper from that distance. And Bowman, because he was unsighted from that distance, he's got the wall up. It's a great strike by Alexander Arnold. But as the ball comes over the wall, he's only seen it from 20 yards away. So by the time it comes over the wall, he's positioned himself in sort of relation to that wall. And he hasn't got time to get across, and the ball's past him before he can get across. So my argument was that, you know, what's the value in actually having that many men in the wall to start with? I think there were six men in the wall. And it's much better and much more beneficial for a goalkeeper to have a clear sight of the ball and be able to see the flight early and pick it up. And if he's in a more central position because of that, there's a greater chance of saving the ball.
Dave, within your piece where you spoke about making the opposition think differently and how they're going to maybe approach the free kick, doing different things, and you spoke about the England under 21 coach as well and some of the ideas that he's got, and you spoke to him about a few things. What would you prefer to do then? Because in my head, what I'm thinking here, Dave, I'm thinking you try and get the people that's or the team that's in that has the free kick, you try and pack the area, you just try and put the keeper off, and everybody moves at the last minute, and then you're going to try and get a rebound. What do the opposition do? What realistically can you do then with this? I know you're saying, if I went up against you from 25 yards beyond, it's unlikely I'm going to score. And how many shooting sessions have you probably been involved in over the years where that certainly has been the case? So what is the suggestion then? What can you do then?
Well, this is it. I mean, speaking to someone like Stevie Woods, who's the he's head of goalkeeping at Celtic and first-team goalkeeping coach there, immediately I spoke about Joe Hart's position and in the summer in the two free kicks that he was beaten by Lee Griffiths. And Stevie was saying, well, if somebody's come against Lee Griffiths and they don't put a wall there, immediately in his mind, what they would do, and they've spoken about this in the coaching staff room as well, that they would put their own wall up there. Now, there's nothing stopping from the opposition, from your own team, putting four men in a wall, creating your own wall, and giving that sort of blinding the goalkeeper and making sure that he has to, again, adjust his position. So there's nothing for a goalkeeper, an opposition team or a team taking the free kick, for them to do that. Mm. But what it is, like you said, and like I said in my piece, it's about making the opposition think and about making them change from what they normally do. If you look at, you take a very top example, like someone like Ronaldo, he has got his routine. You can see it's almost like a Johnny Wilkinson type scenario. He's got a static wall in front of him. Five days a week, he can have a static wall in front of him and he can practice putting the ball and striking the ball over that static wall, and everything around him is set. He gets used to the crowds in front of 60,000 people. That's not going to put him off. He's in his zone. He can see that. Now, once you do things to try and change that and alter his thought process and just put him off, then you sort of lessen the chance of him being in that zone and being able to strike that ball perfectly and affecting the way that he does things.
I'd probably argue Ronaldo hasn't scored a free kick in a number of years, but that's maybe a different catcher. But the one thing, maybe I spoke about it with Joe earlier on as well, surely by not having a wall though, and you perhaps, whether it is the team in who's taking the free kick and you put bodies round it and you're trying to move last minute, and the opposition team, then the one that's defending it, have then got to put themselves in position. A goalkeeper is more susceptible then to a deflection then, surely.
There is that as well. But if you think about, like Stevie Woods has said about putting your own wall up, if you're putting a 4-5-man wall up in front of the taker, then you're taking attacking players out of the box and making the box clearer. So then even if they play the ball into the box, you've got more bodies to defend that in the box. And like I said, it's about not just doing what we've always done. It's not just, there's a free kick, I'm putting the ball down, we put a wall up, I'm going to have a strike at goal. It changes the thought patterns and teams have to start thinking about what they're going to do in games, and it gives players more responsibility to react to what's actually happening rather than just going through the motions of what we always do.
Well, you're talking about innovation is the word actually, and it's amazing when you think we're seeing zonal defence and various innovations right across the game. a wall is one where we've seen very little. I dare say Danny Blanchflower's wall, Flower's wall in 1957 was pretty similar to what we see in 2017. And we were talking earlier as well, certainly from the attacker's point of view, from the free kick taker's point of view, there is no doubt the wall does provide a frame of reference. It does set up an angle for the strike. Somebody likened it earlier on to if you're playing golf with someone and they've got their coin down near enough to the hole, and you can use that as a marker to roll the ball inside or outside. And in many ways, having the wall there lets you set up your trajectory and lets you pick a point to aim over. And almost once it goes over the wall, it takes care of itself afterwards. You've set the ball on its ball flight. And in many respects, it's very useful to the free kick taker, as opposed to just nothing there and having to line everything up without any kind of reference point. And I wanted to ask you as well, I can imagine being in goals. And I've only gone in goals like playing in teams and messing around at times, and there's rarely been a wall. But you make the point as well, seeing the body shape and the run-up at impact gives a goalkeeper so much information about the flight on the ball, as opposed to suddenly seeing this ball come over a wall and you're having to look for the spin on it very quickly, and the amount of information you have is minute by comparison to seeing the striker.
Of course, and your preparation for games takes all that in as well, because you know who's taking the homework that you and your goalkeeper, the goalkeeping coach does, takes all that in effect. Even down to penalties, you know, you look for sort of little sort of tells, little sort of signs about what they're going to do, how they strike the ball, have they got variation, have they got a trademark technique, and I mean, players now there is more variation in free kicks. There is more sort of reverse kicks, so like in a Beckham type of way. So the ball actually starts off going to a keeper's left and ends up going to the right. And so there is a lot of variation like that. But it does give you some in that first 5-10 yards, especially from distance of 25-30 yards. In those 5-10 yards, you gather so much information about where the ball's going to go. And it's not, it's about giving yourself response time and being able to respond. I've no doubt whatsoever in the case last week at Hoffenheim that Bauman, in the end, he didn't even dive.
Yeah.
And I think if he had seen that first flight 5-10 yards, he would have probably would have caught the ball. He would have gotten across easily. But the fact that, like I said, he's only got 20 yards to respond, and the ball's already in flight, so it's gathered pace. It's not just the dead ball from that distance. But also, if you get closer to the goal, the wall does have a... I'm not saying we should get rid of them totally, because once you get right on the edge of the box, of course they serve a purpose. It's very difficult to get a ball up and down over a wall from that distance. But when you've got that 20 yards of space behind the wall, it makes it a lot easier for the taker to get it up and down and over.
Have you tried it, Dave, yourself? Have you tried it with teams that you've been coaching?
Yeah, and it was when I was it all really started when I was over in Denmark, and my coach Viggo Jensen, every day he dragged players into his office and he was talking about things, and he discussed different techniques, sort of if we talk through like a defending or sort of you're attacking a corner. If you've got an attacking corner, usually if they leave two people up front, you'll know yourself, Kevin, they'll have two people marking, or two people behind and one in front. Now, he would always have just three flat players on the halfway line. And he wasn't bothered about the attacking player picking the ball up and turning and running. And his thoughts were that he would always back those three players to defend any number of counterattacks. Mm. So you weren't getting players taken out of the game. They weren't being second to the ball. If you just have that solid three, if you have five attackers versus three defenders, six attackers, you know yourself, it's not easy to break down. You can defend that box.
Yeah.
So it was always these situations that he was making you think and asking you questions all the time. So then I was getting to the age where he was giving me responsibility. You have responsibility, you had input. So then from these shots from distance, I'd put two people in a wall as a token gesture, just to put something in the taker's eye line. But most of the time, I could have a good sight of the ball, and people didn't put a wall in front. And it worked out far better for me.
I saw as well you went for a two-man wall, so split up two walls, two men in each wall, and they guard the sticks or the angles, and then you set up centrally as a goalkeeper. and you get a good view of the striker, which is interesting. I wanted to ask you, because time is tight as well, do you think if you did away with the wall from, I know we're talking slightly further out, so say 27, 28, 29, 30 yards, no wall there, do you still anticipate that the Ericssons of the world, I guess Beckham is a bad example because he was so good, but do you think a lot of those free kick takers who like to curl it with the inside of the foot up and over, do you think they'd still do that even if there wasn't a wall, or would blasting the ball become very much the option?
Well, that's it, and you, it's about putting things in your favour. So if a shot is struck straight on with the laces, you've got a truer flight of the ball, so you can read it better. It's like you said, it's the David Beckhams I mentioned in the piece about Manchester City tried to do it to him. They put a two-man wall, this was 2002 or something like that, I think it was. They put a two-man wall from distance. Now, the way that David Beckham, like I've said before, the way he struck the ball is actually going to your left-hand side, so you're making a motion to go that way, and the ball's got so much vicious dip, it ends up going totally the opposite direction, and you're wrong-footed, and your body weight, it's difficult to shift your body weight to the other side. Yeah. Nicky Weaver was caught out that time. So it's not to say it will never happen, and there's always going to be... there's an old saying that you should never be beaten by that distance by 30 yards, yet we'd see that on a weekly basis in all leagues. So you're never going to stop it, but it's about putting things in your favour and trying to disrupt the opposition.
Dave, I want to get you on in the next few weeks. We haven't got enough time for it now on set pieces. I've heard you talking recently about corners in particular and zonal marking against man marking. I want to get you on that in the next couple of weeks as well. I have a bit more of a chat around that anyway, but that's maybe further down the line.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Good man.
Great. Thanks, Dave. People can check out your piece on the Times website, I presume.
Yeah, it is. I can put a link up
link.
To it.
If, what's the Twitter handle?
It's David Priest 12.
12?
1-2.
Why yeah. 1-2?
Unfortunately, it was my squad number at the time.
Oh, well, listen. It's still a squad number. It's more than I ever got.
And also there was obviously 11 different David Priests that were quicker than me to sound.
Got there, yeah. That's always a signer. Well, David Priest, thanks so much. Pleasure.
Cheers, gents.
All right, David Priest there. Taking a short break.
Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Manchester United, Arsenal and Manchester City are all in live Premier League action this month on the Air Sport Pack.
Interesting from David Priest.
Yeah.
He's largely right, I think. I agree with most of what he's saying, to be honest.
Yeah, I think you touched on a point at the end about players finding ways. Would you still see a Beckham? Would you still see an Ericsson? I think players will find a way to and as soon as someone nails it, it'll be done regularly then. I think what you'll tend to find then, you'll get a player being able to dip a ball, i.e. dipping it in front of a goalkeeper, so where a goalkeeper can't necessarily get hold of it because it's hit with sufficient power.
So bounce it before him.
Bounce it before him, yeah. And you'll be able to get that dip on the ball. I think you'll be able to get that.
Look at you, the great innovator.
Well, it's not that, because you can't necessarily pack the area because with the free kick taking team, because you're going to be offside, of course.
Uh-huh.
So I think you'll also get players coming in from the side trying to get the rebound. I think that's what you might try to get. And as we've seen with many goalkeepers, if it is dipping in front of them, you'll see mistakes. But it actually gets past them as well.
That makes sense, you know. And it's less risky than going out and out for the knockout punch.
Yeah.
Just pump it in there. Let them deal with the bouncing ball, and we'll all run in on top of it.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah.
We're pretty much done for this evening. Earlier on, we asked you how many All-Ireland Senior Hurling titles Waterford have won. The answer, of course, is 2 for now. And congratulations to Melanie Ford, who wins a pair of tickets. Melanie, you're coming along to our Off the Ball Roadshow end of the month. And if you missed out tonight, listen to tomorrow for another chance to win. That's the Off the Ball Roadshow live from Galway, 31st of August, with thanks to Bord Gáis Energy, hashtag hurling to the core. So we're pretty much done. You can download the Andy Lee, Paddy Collins chat on McGregor Mayweather earlier on. And of course, the football show. If you're just tuning in now, we'll see you tomorrow. Usual time, 7 o'clock. Tom Dunn's on the way next. Good luck.
Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.